Based on the overall lack of pirate regalia and colanders, I am guessing that most of you were not raised in the ways of the flying spaghetti monster. Pastafarianism, as the belief in the flying spaghetti monster, or FSM is known, is apparently so statistically small that it does not register in either the 2007 or the 2014 U.S. Religions Landscape Study by the Pew Research Center. This could be a simple statistical aberration, or, more likely, another proof that the flying spaghetti monster exists. After all, what is the point of faith or belief in something that obviously exists? I digress briefly here to point to the final proof of the non-existence of God as it was presented in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Quote, "I refuse to prove that I exist, says God, for proof denies faith, and without faith, I am nothing. But, says man, the Babel fish is a dead giveaway, isn't it? It could not have evolved by chance. It proves that you exist, and so, therefore, by your own arguments, you don't. QED. As I note now, many of you are not carrying towels either, or your Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy with the words "Don't Panic" emblazoned on the cover. So I realize that you may not be fully familiar with the function of the Babel fish. So very briefly, I will indicate that it is a small, yellow, leech-like fish which, quote, feeds on brainwave energy, absorbing all unconscious frequencies and then excreting telepathically a matrix formed from the conscious frequencies and nerve signals picked up by the speech centers of the brain, the practical upshot of which is that if you stick one in your ear, you can instantly understand anything said to you in any form of language. The speech you hear decodes the brainwave matrix. Take that, Google Translate and Siri and those silly things we call phones. If you are still having trouble grasping the earlier argument, let me simplify it a bit. Imagine that the Babel fish is a watch. Let's say one of those fancy old pocket watches. Maybe you got it from your grandfather. Just as you can look at the watch and from its existence infer that there must have been a watchmaker, this is called the theory of intelligent design, so one can also, according to this theory, infer God from the existence of the Babel fish. And we have all witnessed just how badly this idea has backfired when it turns out that the very thing that makes us think he exists proves he doesn't. But that is why we have logic. Now, to return to what I was originally saying, the FSM works in mysterious ways. An eradication of statistics and the creation of misleading information, such as a false fossil record, is all part of that mystery. Many of you, I am sure, are familiar with the Robert Frost poem, The Road Not Taken, in which a young hiker in a yellow forest is confronted by a fork in his path, and being unable to take both routes presented, erroneously selects the one, quote, less traveled by, and imagines that in the future created by this choice, that has made all the difference. Robert Frost was not a pastafarian. To see only two paths and to select only one is not the way of the pastafarian. If I were Robert Frost, I might say that today's sermon could have been titled Only One of Two Ways. One way might have been to call it The Evolution of Belief, How Religions Need to Reinvent Themselves to Remain Relevant to Society. Or the second choice, and the one I did call it, A Nun's Guide to Building Your Own Religion. On the first path, I would no doubt have talked about the history of religion, sounding like a professor, maybe describing how Judaism begat Christianity, which begat the Catholic Church, which begat Protestantism, which begat the Unitarian Universalism, which may or may not be an uncle, it would have to be an uncle as it has to start with a U, to the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster. Whereas on the second path, I would no doubt have talked about how religions are created and provided actual directions on how to build a religion of your own. In this case, probably sounding like a real estate agent with a pastoral complex. Have you thought about a family room? What good is a religion without a decent-sized family room? That is, if you have kids, or if you want to have kids. And south-facing, You do love nature, don't you? What about your moral code? Locks on all the doors? Cleanliness, maybe a jacuzzi to wash away your sins. Or maybe you don't believe in dirt. How do you feel about flying pasta? But this is not my approach. Instead, I ask myself one simple question. It's right there on the cover of your order of service. WWF-SMD. What would the flying spaghetti monster do? The answer was obvious. Imagine, if you will, a bowl of spaghetti. You may butter it in your imagination if you wish, or add some olive oil, as it can be a bit dry. Additionally, you can imagine the pasta as to be wheat-based or rice-based, gluten-free, however you need to imagine it. That, after all, is the power of the imagination. When you look at that bowl of pasta, you do not find two paths, but many paths. And those paths are intertwined, crossing over and under each other. There can be many strands of pasta. Unlike Robert Frost's Young Hiker, you do not come to a fork in your path. Instead, you come to that bowl of pasta with a fork in hand. You wind the spaghetti onto your fork, and you eat it. And some of the spaghetti has to be slurped up because it doesn't always stay wound or because it is peculiarly long. That is the way I decided to write this sermon. This is all one bowl of pasta, bits and pieces intertwined. And you may not find it logically arranged. There may be bits that start in one place, and then something else comes along. You will find a lot of questions that are not answered, perhaps because pasta curls like a question mark. But remember, this is all one bowl of pasta, and at the end, I hope you will not be hungry. It is probably best to start simply, so forget for the moment about the flying spaghetti monster. Forget about the history of religion and who begat who, and forget about how religions are made, which history indicates has a disquieting similarity to the making of sausage. Start with a clean slate. I want you to ask yourself this very simple question and answer it inside your head. What is 2 times 2? In 1926, Edward Esplin Cummings, commonly known as E.E. Cummings and godfather to our modern lack of punctuation and no doubt ersatz uncle to the tweet, published his fifth book of poems, to which he wrote the following introduction. On the assumption that my technique is either complicated or original or both, the publishers have politely requested me to write an introduction to this book. At least my theory of technique, if I have one, is very far from original, nor is it complicated. I can express it in 15 words by quoting the eternal question and immortal answer of burlesque, viz., would you hit a woman with a child? No, I'd hit her with a brick. Like the burlesque comedian, I am abnormally fond of that precision which creates movement. If a poet is anybody, he is somebody to whom things made matter very little, somebody who is obsessed by making. Like all obsessions, the making obsession has disadvantages. For instance, my only interest in making money would be to make it. Fortunately, however, I should prefer to make almost anything else, including locomotives and roses. It is with roses and locomotives, not to mention acrobat, spring, electricity, Coney Island, the 4th of July, the eyes of mice, and Niagara Falls, that my poems are competing. They are also competing with each other, with elephants, and with El Greco. Ineluctable preoccupation with the verb gives a poet one priceless advantage, whereas non-makers must content themselves with the merely undeniable fact that 2 times 2 is 4, he rejoices in a purely irresistible truth to be found in abbreviated costume upon the title page of this present volume. The title of E.E. Cummings' book of poems is 5. If you answered 4 to the original question of what is 2 times 2, you may not be able to build your own religion. In the spring of 1820, a 14-year-old boy named Joseph, faced with many religions to choose from, went into a grove of trees near his home in Palmyra, New York, and prayed to learn what church he should join. Think about that for a minute. There's an amazing logic to this idea. If there is one true God and one true religion, and that one God listens to and answers prayers, who better to ask what religion one should be a member of? No secondary source is needed. Just ask through prayer, or better yet, through a divine messenger, and God will answer you. This, to me, is the essence of Protestantism and the ultimate in individualism. Direct revelation. God and me, tête-à-tête, if you'll pardon my simulated French. Have you ever been faced with a choice between religions? Pew Research Center indicates that this is a common event. People switch from one religion to another. People switch from no religion to a religion, and they also switch from a religion to no religion. The base statistics don't indicate why this occurs, just that it does. Is there a logic to it? Is there a pattern? Why does this happen? Although Joseph, when faced with a myriad of religions, applies a kind of logic to solving the question of what religion is the right one, the logic is not what we call science. It is all untestable premises, premises which are already in contention with day-to-day reality. After all, if there is one true God, why are there so many religions? And if God listens to and answers prayers, why didn't I get that bicycle on my 7th birthday, the one with the banana seat and the chopper handlebars, and those things on the spokes that made that little clickety sound? Although it is a logical form without science, and this is a valid criticism of the form and a definite weakness, at the same time, it is a kind of action, a kind of making an answer to something that science can't or doesn't answer. What religion should I join? If we ask the question earnestly, do we move from E.E. Cummings' merely undeniable fact, an existence of 2 times 2 is 4, to a purely irresistible truth, an is 5? I would say no. Religion, however, would want you to say yes. After all, few religions are particularly fact-driven, at least not in the way that we commonly understand facts. Crime investigation shows are fact-driven, or at least they pretend to be. Math is fact-driven. Religion, however, is, what shall we call it? Truth-driven. It wants to align its facts to what it already believes and accepts as true. Despite this, religions, as unscientific and illogical as they often are, tend to be tied down to a certain kind of logic and structure of their own. They become caught in their own closed circuits. For example, Jesus performs miracles such as turning water into wine. This is an awesome power. But he never turns the head of a person into that of a donkey, which occurs in Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream. And there is no part of the writings of St. Paul where he says, on the road to Damascus, the Lord turned me into a newt. I got better. Why not? The scope of miracles are, I would suggest, reined in by some specific truth that is being professed. And having been reined in, they are, or become, as mundane as 2 times 2 is 4. Mundane. What an excellent word here. Humdrum, dull, boring, tedious, monotonous, tiresome, unremarkable, commonplace. Ordinary. It also means earthly. Mundus, the earth. Plain as dirt, one might say. Which, by the way, is by no means a plain substance, even though we treat it as one. A religion concerned with the otherworldly becomes mundane. How mundane? Well, did you ever memorize a creed, a set of commandments, a prayer? As a member of church, are there certain specific ways that things are done? A liturgy, a repetition of hymns and holidays. Newness has a tendency to wear off. Things we learn by rote, like your times tables, may provide a kind of comfort as well as usefulness when, for example, you are calculating how many dozen eggs you will need to feed 30 people, but they are also mundane. Oh, look, says the person raised in the world where miracles are common, another miracle. My water has turned into wine. You know what else turns water into wine? Grapes. You know what else is mundane? Pasta. But a flying spaghetti monster? That is certainly an is five, if there ever was one. In February of 1866, A 44-year-old woman named Mary had a severe fall, suffering injuries that left her in bed. After 3 days while reading her Bible, she was suddenly healed. This is a woman who was often sick as a child. She was probably one of those people who always got whatever was going around. You got a cough, she got the full-blown flu. You had a slight itch on your left elbow, she got the measles. The science of medicine was more oxymoron than actual practice. People were still touting all kinds of cures based on the historical humors of the body. You remember these. Black bile, yellow bile, phlegm, and blood. Sickness was an imbalance in these humors, either an excess or a deficit of one or more of these humors. The humors had interesting symbolic relationships with earth, air, fire, and water, and additionally with the simple relationships of the opposites, hot and cold, wet and dry. Fever and a runny nose, hot and wet. Seems blood-related and bad air. Shivers and a dry cough, dry and cold. Seems black bile-related and bad earth. The system of explanations and diagnoses weren't arbitrary. They had their own logic and methods. It's just that they didn't have any kind of proven record. At the same time, there were new and crazy ideas, something called germs that you could see only under a microscope. Scary enough to make you want to stop drinking your own pond water. Animal magnetism, mesmerism, jars of patent medicines made by seemingly honest people in brown suits, people who could talk to spirits. The question this woman faced is one that we all do. How do I get well? How do I stay healthy? Like the boy faced with too many churches, the world had thrown an abundance of choices at her, a lot of promises, and not a good way to select what was right. What would heal her? And so she spent 3 days in bed reading her Bible. And she was cured. Imagine being able to cure yourself of anything, and that you can learn how to do this simply by reading the Bible. Okay, I admit as a reader that the Bible would not be my first choice of books. I'd prefer something more adventuresome like Alexandre Dumas' The Count of Monte Cristo or Michael Ondaatje's The English Patient. But to my knowledge, no one has based the ability to cure yourself on either of these two books. Are science and religion in a deadly struggle? Are they pitted against each other? For at least 4 centuries, science has provided a means of testing patterns we find in nature and leading us to ones that are repeatable in ways that are useful. It has led to things like the refrigerator magnet that actually clings to the side of your refrigerator, as long as your refrigerator is not stainless steel or made of wood. Single-wrapped slices of cheese, the disposable plastic spork, and, of course, Velcro. None of these things appear to conflict with any particular religion, except for Velcro being thought the spawn of Satan by those who believe that God gave us shoelaces. However, science also happens to have made some statements about the arrangement of the solar system, how old the world is, and that people have evolved from monkeys. "Whoa there," said many religions. "You've already answered these questions, and your different answers are just causing problems by causing people to ask new questions." So yes, there has been a conflict between science and religion in the answers that have been proposed. But this is no different than the conflict between one religion and another, which propose different answers to the same question. At an underlying level, both science and religion are doing the same thing. They are both trying to answer questions. And they're using the same brain to do it. Religions, for the most part, have always premised that people are special, having been given the ability to make choices and believe in God. They were just made that way. Scientists, on the other hand, have had a long battle of trying to understand how people's brains work and has suggested that as part of evolution, we moved from having brains that function like a Swiss Army knife to ones with cognitive fluidity. In other words, we moved from a specialized to a generalized type of mentality. This, says archaeologist Stephen Mithen, enabled people to design complex tools, to create art, and believe in religious ideologies. Moreover, the potential for other types of thought, which are critical to the modern world, can be laid at the door of cognitive fluidity. In other words, to simplify the overall picture, imagine that our brain has what Michael Shermer in his book, How We Believe, calls a belief engine. The belief engine takes input from the world around us and spits out both scientific thinking and magical thinking. It doesn't in and of itself distinguish the output. We are not scientists first or religious first. We are capable of both. And the belief engine is not designed in a 2 times 2 is 4 manner, but an is-5 manner. That is, it allows us to propose multiple answers to the same questions, to change our answers to fit our needs and our understanding of the world around us. There is no cap on what we can imagine. So, for instance, if we take the exceptionally bland but oft-asked question, why did the chicken cross the road, and run it through our cognitively fluid belief engine, we may get not one answer, but a variety of answers. Here are 7 possible ones to get to the other side. Charles Darwin might say it was the next step after coming down from the trees. James T. Kirk would answer, to boldly go where no chicken has gone before. Albert Einstein would point out, whether the chicken crossed the road or the road crossed the chicken depends upon your frame of reference. Carl Sagan would elaborate, there are billions and billions of chickens crossing roads just like this one all across the universe. Stephen Hawking would explain, chicken fluctuations will inevitably create a scenario where a chicken ends up on the other side of the yellow line, in which case there is a non-zero probability that it will escape to the other side. And someone, somewhere, perhaps a chicken itself, would say, I dream of a world one day where chickens can cross the road without having their motives questioned. Remember that word for a moment, motives. Imagine that science and religion sit down together to play a game. Using the same belief engine, together they define a set of rules on how the game will be played. The object of the game is to move your marker along a path from the starting point to the ending point. How will the markers be moved? We will roll this pair of dice, says science, and move the number of spaces that they show. Science explains that the dice will randomly show numbers outside the control of either player. We will each take turns. Okay, says religion after testing the dice. But I do not believe the numbers are random. They are set by my God. In fact, if you roll a 7, says religion, that is a special number, and you will get to move those spaces and roll again. Okay, says science. I'm fine with that. You can believe what you want. They start playing. At some point, science pulls ahead. Religion rolls the dice, and they show a 6. 7, says religion, and moves 7 and goes to roll again. Wait a minute, says science. That was a 6. No, says religion, it was a 7. You said I can believe what I want, and I believe it was a 7. It may have appeared to you to be a 6 because you don't believe. I'm sorry you don't have my God to help you see this. Says science, we're going to have a problem if we can't make a social contract that works for both of us. You said I could believe anything I want, says religion. Perhaps that was a mistake, says science. If we can't agree to use the number that shows to both of us on the dice, then we can no longer play the game. In order to successfully work in society, both science and religion have to have a social contract. Science takes part in the social contract by proposing that its methods are visible to everyone, can be shared and taught. The scientific process specifically attempts to eliminate individual values and arbitrary whims. But I can't refute belief, says science, so how can I politely question it? Maybe I should invite another religion to the game. Let's talk about movement and the rise of the nuns. E.E. Cummings is abnormally fond of that precision which creates movement. The idea of movement that he presents is what I would call a mind shift. It is a reinterpretation of the meaning of a question, often in a humorous way. Would you hit a woman with a child? No, I'd hit her with a brick. The answer reinterprets the question from being about whether or not you would hit a woman to instead to be about the materials you would use. The question has a subtext about what kind of person you are, as there is an unstated hierarchy of bad behaviors. Hitting a person is bad. Hitting a woman is worse. Hitting a pregnant woman, even worse. By asking the question at all, the questioner is indicating that you are unpredictable, that you have already done something that causes the question to need to be asked, and that you probably don't conform to social norms. The reply of no initially conforms to the expected answer. The no might commonly even be followed by a counter question of, what kind of person do you think I am? To which the unstated answer would no doubt be, I think you are the kind of person who would hit a pregnant woman and then lie about it. Thus the reply of, no, I would hit her with a brick, goes the extra distance of both making fun of the question by purposefully misconstruing it and acts as a counterattack with the implied subtext of, what kind of person goes about asking loaded questions and making insinuations? Let's be blunt here. You don't like me, but I call a brick a brick. The Pew Research Center indicates that there is ongoing movement in religions. Some people end up switching from one religion to another. Some people switch from no religion to having one. And some people switch from having a religion to having none. In particular, the statistics indicate that the number of people who say they have no religion is growing. These people are collectively being referred to as the nuns. No, they don't wear strange hats and dark robes. It's just a group name that people have given them. Some of the nuns say they are spiritual, some atheists, others agnostics, and some are just, well, yawning. Although the statistics indicate the change, they don't by themselves do much explaining. So we have to ask the question, why are the nuns on the rise? What kind of people are they? Why are existing religions failing to appeal to them? And of course, is this a sign of the coming apocalypse? These are the normal one questions one would ask, well, except for the apocalypse one. But I want to ask something different than these. My question is this. Is the movement among religions and the rise of the nuns like the movement that E.E. Cummings is talking about? Is it a movement obsessed with making? And if so, what is it making? Poets make poems. What do the nuns make in place of religion? Perhaps a new religion. The boy, Joseph Smith, who in 1820 thought to ask God what church he should join, apparently learned that none of the existing churches and religions really had the truth of things. So on April 6, 1830, he organized the Church of Latter-day Saints. The woman, Mary Baker Eddy, who miraculously healed herself back in 1866 after reading her Bible, went on to publish the book Science and Health in 1875, and in 1879, she founded the Church of Christ Scientist. In 2005, a young student, Bobby Henderson, wrote the following letter to the Kansas State Board of Education. Open letter to Kansas School Board. I am writing you with much concern after having read of your hearing to decide whether the alternative theory of intelligent design should be taught along with the theory of evolution. I think we can all agree that it is important for students to hear multiple viewpoints so that they can choose for themselves the theory that makes the most sense to them. I am concerned, however, that students will only hear one theory of intelligent design. Let us remember that there are multiple theories of intelligent design. I and many others around the world are of the strong belief that the universe was created by a flying spaghetti monster. It was he who created all that we see and all that we feel. We feel strongly that the overwhelming scientific evidence pointing towards evolutionary processes is nothing but a coincidence put in place by him. It is for this reason that I am writing to you today to formally request that this alternative theory be taught in your schools along with the other two theories. In fact, I will go so far as to say, if you do not agree to do this, we will be forced to proceed with legal action. I'm sure you see where we are coming from. If the intelligent design theory is not based on faith, but instead another scientific theory, as is claimed, then you must also allow our theory to be taught, as it is also based on science, not on faith. Some find that hard to believe, so it may be helpful to tell you a little more about our beliefs. We have evidence that a flying spaghetti monster created the universe. None of us, of course, were around to see it, but we have written accounts of it. We have several lengthy volumes explaining all details of his power. Also, you may be surprised to hear that there are over 10 million of us, and growing. We tend to be very secretive, as many people claim our beliefs are not substantiated by observable evidence. What these people don't understand is that he built the world to make us think the Earth is older than it really is. For example, a scientist may perform a carbon dating process on an artifact. He finds that approximately 75% of the carbon-14 has decayed by electron emission to nitrogen-14 and infers that this artifact is approximately 10,000 years old, as the half-life of carbon-14 appears to be 5,730 years. But what our scientist does not realize is that every time he makes a measurement, the flying spaghetti monster is there changing the results with his noodly appendage. We have numerous texts that describe in detail how this can be possible and the reasons why he does this. He is, of course, invisible and can pass through matter with ease. I'm sure you now realize how important it is that your students are taught this alternate theory. It is absolutely imperative that they realize that observable evidence is at the discretion of the flying spaghetti monster. Furthermore, it is disrespectful to teach our beliefs without wearing his chosen outfit, which, of course, is full pirate regalia. I cannot stress the importance of this enough, and unfortunately cannot describe in detail why this must be done, as I fear this letter is already becoming too long. The concise explanation is that he becomes angry if we don't. You may be interested to know that global warming, earthquakes, hurricanes, and other natural disasters are a direct effect of the shrinking numbers of pirates since the 1800s. For your interest, I have included a graph, and he included a graph, of the approximate number of pirates versus the average global temperature over the last 200 years. And as you can see, there is a statistically significant inverse relationship between pirates and global temperature. It's true, fewer pirates, warmer weather. In conclusion, thank you for taking the time to hear our views and beliefs. I hope I was able to convey the importance of teaching this theory to your students. We will, of course, be able to train the teachers in this alternate theory. I am eagerly awaiting your response and hope dearly that no legal action will need to be taken. I think we can all look forward to the time when these three theories are given equal time in our science classrooms across the country and eventually the world. One third time for intelligent design, one third time for flying spaghetti monsterism, Pastafarianism, and one third time for logical conjecture based on overwhelming observable evidence. Sincerely yours, Bobby Henderson, Concerned Citizen. P.S. I have included an artistic drawing of him creating a mountain, trees, and a midget. Remember, we are all his creatures. Some people find a religion. Some people are found by a religion, and other people found a religion. Perhaps even accidentally. If you have ever been a seeker, someone who left one religion to find another, or who had no religion and then sought one, you know that people use their religious beliefs to justify all kinds of behavior. When seeking a new religion, do you look for a new belief, or do you instead look for a religion that agrees with what you already believe? And if you can't find a religion that agrees with you, with what you already believe, what is it that would push you to create one? Let's talk about motives. Bobby Henderson's letter to the Kansas School Board was specifically motivated to counter the inclusion of intelligent design, also known as creationism, as part of the science curriculum. It uses irony in the absurdity of a flying spaghetti monster to make the argument that by opening the curriculum to one non-scientific theory, you will, in the end, have to be open to any non-scientific theory. Implicit in this argument is that the motivation for inclusion of intelligent design in the curriculum is based on an existing religious ideology. It was chosen not because it is an alternative scientific argument, but because it was a belief that someone or some group wanted to promote. Or to put it more bluntly, it's an advertisement for a specific religion or religious belief. Because irony pits the literal meaning of what is being said against the intention of why you are saying it, Henderson's letter does two things at the same time. It literally creates the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster, and at the same time stands outside that creation to show how silly it is. I would argue that the tension between the literal meaning and the interpreted meaning creates the same kind of movement that E.E. Cummings wrote about. It becomes a way of making something new. Is the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster a real religion? Well, yes. But there are not stringent rules of any kind about what constitutes a real religion. You can, in fact, go to the internet and look up how to create a religion. For instance, at Instructables.com, it suggests six basic items you should think about. They are: 1. Choose a focus, a central theme, idea, or person. 2. Create a central belief consisting of 2 or 3 main dogmas. 3. Design your rituals. 4. Pay attention to aesthetics in terms of materials, symbols, etc. 5. Choose your role. Who are you in this religion? And 6. Advertise, advertise, advertise. So using the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster as an example, does it fulfill these instructions? Let's take a look. 1. Central person, flying spaghetti monster. 2. Central belief. Although the original letter to the Kansas School Board focused specifically on intelligent design, the condiments, or the 8 I'd really rather you didn't, soon followed. In shortened and expurgated form, they are: I'd really rather you didn't act like a sanctimonious, holier-than-thou fool when describing my noodly goodness. If some people don't believe in me, that's okay. 2, I'd really rather you didn't use my existence as a means to oppress, subjugate, punish, eviscerate, and or, you know, be mean to others. 3, I'd really rather you didn't judge people for the way they look or how they dress or the way they talk or, well, just play nice, okay? I'd really rather you didn't indulge in conduct that offends yourself or your willing consenting partner of legal age and mental maturity. I'd really rather you didn't challenge the bigoted, misogynist, hateful ideas of others on an empty stomach. Eat, and then go. And 6, I'd really rather you didn't build multi-million-dollar churches, temples, mosques, shrines, to my noodly goodness, when the money could be better spent doing, take your pick, ending poverty, curing diseases, or living in peace, loving with passion, and lowering the cost of cable. I'd really rather you didn't go around telling people I talk to you. You're not that interesting. Get over yourself. And 8, I'd really rather you didn't do unto others as you would have them do unto you. If you're into, that stuff that uses a lot of leather lubricant, Las Vegas, you know. If the person is into it, however, pursuant to 4, then have at it. Now, most religions have rules specifically for their adherents. But what if the rules or suggestions were, in this case, meant to apply to other religions? That is, they are meta-rules to be used to clean up behavior. Perhaps more than anything else, what Pastafarianism brings to the forefront is the ability to criticize mainstream religions, to reintroduce skepticism and our ability to question things, even beliefs, and to try and do it as politely as possible. As odd as Pastafarianism is, it is not alone in its work to recreate religion. There are others out there, invisible pink unicorns, Last Thursdayism, Bokenism, which comes from Kurt Vonnegut's Cat's Cradle and promotes comforting lies called FOMA, the Church of the Subgenius, Dudism, which is a religion based on the 1998 film The Big Lebowski, Jediism from Star Wars, and Our Lady of Perpetual Exemption, a religious movement from Last Week Tonight with John Oliver. Will these religions evolve? Will they cause other religions to evolve? Perhaps only time will tell. And there's one tiny piece of pasta left in the bowl. Since 2008, the FSM has had a team on Kiva, a microloan site aimed at ending poverty. That team has provided $2,742,300 in loans. If reality is about doing things that make a difference in the world and not just about belief, then the Pastafarians have put themselves out there and are as real as any one of us.